Subdued, episode 126. As your host is fighting his way through it, my co-host Barry Rose. We're here to break kayfabe on just about everything. So, Barry, how you doing today, my man?
I guess I'm a little concerned, Jeff, because apparently my gimmick now is your gimmick. You got some stomach issues going on. They're shitting all over the place, and I may start holding my chin, Jeff, in all my photos going forward.
I got to stop eating that Ethiopian food, Barry.
Yeah, you do. But hey, you wanted to drop a couple of pounds, and I think you're succeeding in your goal now, right?
This is not a way I'd recommend it. I'm less fleshy than I was a couple of weeks ago. I can just say that. Before we start breaking kayfabe on just about everything, a couple points we want to bring up. I just want to mention we're going to hear Barry's New Mexico story this week. We are going to be joined this week, I promise, by the Tennessee stud Ron Fuller to push CWF Legends Fan Fest that's upcoming. We are going to be looking at a match from January of 1994. And Barry, this is a real rip snorter as we're talking loser leave town in a cage, the Rock and Roll Express versus the Heavenly Bodies, Pikeville, Kentucky. It's Bluegrass Brawl 2. And we are going to do what appears to be impossible, Barry. We are going to discuss Sirius XM's top 1000 classic rock songs. Very important you remember that title too, classic rock songs, because quite frankly, there's a few songs on this list that I go, how the fuck is this classic rock? So, you ready to go, Barry?
I'm ready to go, too. And I got to say, too, so I actually like Sirius XM. That is one thing. I listen to Sirius on a daily basis, whether it's the New Wave channel, which is First Wave 33, or the two Howard Stern channels. I seem to live on all of those. So, I am a big fan of the product. However, Jeff, the list of these 1,000 songs, not a huge fan.
Well, you know, it's... You try to come up with a list of 1,000 songs, okay, that are quote-unquote classic rock songs. And, I mean, we're going to get to listen a little bit, but there's just some selections on here that I find kind of bizarre because, you know, I'm thinking, especially since they have I Listen to Classic Rewind, and I'm, like, looking at some of these songs by relatively famous names, and I'm going, I've never heard this song on the radio before. Now, I'm sure... To certain, I'm going to call them music snobs out there, and I think you know who I'm talking about. They will say, oh, yeah, that was on Deep. There's a Deep Tracks channel. That was on Zeppelin's Live from Tokyo bootleg CD on side B of, you know, Stairway to Heaven. Like, oh, come on. It's a song that's never fucking played on the radio. And so that's my problem. So if you're going to have this song on the list, I'm sorry, it should be a little lower on the list. I understand 1,000 fucking songs. You need to kind of flesh out the list, but why is something, you know, that's barely ever played on the radio, if ever, why is that in front of somebody that's a, you know, something that's a staple of classic rock radio? Huh, we'll get to that in just a second. Before we do, Barry, let's hit on a couple of topics here. First of all, we do not have a guest this week. Oh, Barry, I do believe we were supposed to have a guest last week. He may have actually got mentioned in a non-edited segment. Who was that person that was supposed to be here last week? And would you like to say anything about that individual?
I put you right on the fucking spot. Oh, absolutely. And I would love to stay for the next half hour. However, he is making... So it was Pat Tanaka, and Pat Tanaka was supposed to be on our show. Was it not edited out of the show? Is that what I'm getting?
It was not. You made a reference to Pat, but he did not make the appearance, obviously.
Yeah, he did not. And I'm not quite sure what happened. He may have been headlining Madison Square Garden and drawing 55,000 people, or wrestling in his sixth decade, even though he's like, you know, 50 something years old or whatever it is. But Pat, we spoke to him briefly and he said, can you call me back in a half an hour? And we did. And that was that. We never had Pat Tanaka on. However, he is making some appearances for a good friend of ours, which is Nick Massey. So I do know that Pat will be showing up for those. And sometimes when there is a payday involved, Jeff, it changes everything. So I believe that's what's actually happening. I wasn't aware that wasn't edited out, though. I
made a reference to Pat on the show. Let's just say that.
Okay.
In the words of someone I used to know, he shined us like a new dime. That's all I'm going to say. So, Barry, next, I want to make a reference to a recent situation we had on the old Facebook group.
Uh-oh.
We had a bit of, I think you said, Barry, a picadillo, a little problem. You see what I did there?
I appreciate that.
So let me show you folks, or tell you folks, how you handle something and how you do not handle something. The way not to handle it is to go on a board and become a heel. we've had people in the past that have tried to do this. And, you know, apparently they think it's a fun gimmick to try and be a heel. And said person in question came on, it's kind of like an asshole. And, you know, we have two rules in the group, Barry. Don't be an asshole and no politics. Pretty simple stuff, basically. But someone decided that they were going to try to be the asshole, try to see if they could get over as a heel. And I think Mr. Rose, I think you put him in his place.
I think I did. And I, you know, so what really got to me, and he may be listening right now. And Jeff, I don't know if you saw, but he actually sent us a message.
I did not get that.
Because we're not, because we're not friends with him, it went to that other area of Facebook messages that don't, you have to kind of look for it, but we got one. And yeah, he was a little more, you know, he wasn't quite as coming off quite as abrasively, I guess he did. But
for me,
it was one thing that he did, and it was compared us to Alex Jones. And I got to be honest, I don't mind criticism. In some ways, I think it's kind of fun. And criticism is just one guy's opinion. I'm absolutely fine with that. You know, it's always been consider the source. You know, if somebody you love and care deeply for gives you a critical opinion, maybe you take that to heart. But when this goofball, I don't really give a shit. But it was, Jeff, was this comparison to Alex Jones. And there is a burr up my asshole for Alex Jones that I only have for a couple of people in my life. And I don't want to get political here. There's a reason, right? We don't get political. But the whole denying Sandy Hook thing fucking freaks me out and gets me really upset. So,
I'll just say what really got to burr up my saddle.
If he had said Jesse Ventura, who's a conspiracy theorist, I would have laughed that off. Exactly.
Well, what really got to burr my saddle, Barry, is when he discussed the fact that we were, what was the word? He didn't say unprepared. It was, did poor research on our unsolved mysteries. I don't know if he was talking about you or me. I don't think he can say that about you because you definitely did some research on the last episode. If he found my research lacking, you know, there's certainly venues and avenues you can take where you can address that to me privately as opposed to deciding to put yourself over in the group. Now, I want to show you a comparison, Barry, to the way you should do it. Okay. So friend of the show, Kevin Orcutt, reached out to me privately on Facebook Messenger regarding another topic on this show that we've had recently where we discussed the AEW product, okay, and the fact that your son was watching it with groups at Pittsburgh University, and I want to just read to you because I haven't told you about this what Kevin wrote to us, okay?
Well, Jeff, if I can say,
you got it too?
Yes, sir. And I responded as well.
I shouldn't be surprised by that. But what Kevin wrote, okay, is don't be fooled just because Barry's son and his friends love AEW doesn't mean everyone in their early 20s feels the same way. There are certain aspects of AEW that I appreciate and other aspects that I completely despise. I would get rid of everyone on the roster except for Moxley, Jeff Cobb, The Inner Circle, Cody and Dustin, Adam Page, Jungle Boy, Luchasaurus, Pac, MJF, and Wardlow, Darby Allin. He's basically told the whole friggin' roster there.
Yes.
The Blade and the Butcher, Trent Beretta, Nyla Rose, Awesome Kong, and Britt Baker. Everyone else I'd get rid of. Kevin, I don't know who else is left, quite frankly. But anyway, my point is, he made a point of reaching out to each of us, okay, and, you know, basically saying, I disagree with what you said. He could have put that on the board, okay? I don't have a problem with that because he's not being disrespectful. He was just disagreeing with our opinion. Guess what? You're allowed to do that. You're allowed to say, hey, Jeff, hey, Barry, I don't think you guys were correct on this. Let me tell you why. As long as you're not an asshole about it, you can always do that. We're not perfect. Barry's close, but, you know, other than that, we're not perfect. So, you know, I just want to stress that we encourage differences of opinion if done so respectfully. What the prior individual did that I mentioned was he did so very disrespectfully. And so guess what? You mess with the bull, you get the fucking horns. You know what I mean?
Look, at the end of the day, and I'll get on Kevin Orcutt in just a second as well. But at the end of the day, it is just a Facebook group. We clearly have to state this is just a podcast. We're not trying to change the world here in any form. Even when we do our unsolved mysteries, there is a lot of research that goes into it, but we don't expect this to be the end all be all. And look, even when I go back to Tank Morgan and we discussed that this was a hit that took place, you know, other than putting together some clues and speaking to people who knew him and looking at the facts, we don't know for a fact that this is a hit. Again, we're not changing the world. We're not solving crimes. Just don't fucking compare us to Alex Jones. So, same exact message from Kevin Orcutt, except he said, just because your son So other than that wording, I think it's identical. However, I did have a response, and it was, look, Kevin reaches out after every show. I believe it's every single show, and gives us some sort of commentary, whether he's agreeing or disagreeing or adding facts to it. But my response to him was, data analytics show that AEW skews to a younger viewing parties. There's a reason they are beating NXT every single week. And it's not the quality of wrestling. It's the way the show is being presented, which I do believe it comes across. And Jeff, you and I were texting last night. I actually did catch the last 20 minutes of AEW, and it was great. Holy shit, that angle between Moxley and Chris Jericho. We saw blood 2 weeks in a row now on AEW. I'm really enjoying it.
And, you know, I got to say, I happen to listen to Jim Cornette's recent podcast with Brian, and they were reviewing AEW. And
wait, you were with Brian? When
no,
you heard
I was just listening to the show.
Oh, okay.
It was Jimmy with Brian. And so I was listening to the show, and they made some criticisms and some, you know, stuff that they felt was well done, which I thought was fair, you know, and balanced. But one of the things that they said was, before that, they had reviewed the week's Raw show, and they said it might have been the worst 2 hours of episodic television and TV history, that it was that bad. It was so poorly done, so poorly booked, so poorly written, that it was all they could do just to, you know, keep up with the product for 2 hours. Now, mind you, that's the WWE staple product. That's their go-to product. And it was so bad that two guys that have spent their life around wrestling could barely get through it because it was so awful. I mean, you know, and the fact that, you know, I know AEW is beating NXT. I don't think that AEW is ever going to outdraw Raw because of a lot of reasons, the Fox affiliation, everything. But man, and I don't watch WWE Raw, okay? But if the product is that bad, you really have to wonder about the future of this company, you know? And I don't say that meaning that I think they're going to go out of business. No, they're well stocked for the future with the Fox contract and everything. But you really have to worry about their product, Barry.
Yeah, well, AEW actually on a weekly basis is putting forth something that I think is compelling viewing. Jeff, did you just hear that sound? It's Ryan Damon falling to the ground, clutching his heart. every time we say something positive about AEW, one of our listeners, Ryan Damon from Massachusetts, seems to hate that aspect of it. But look, Raw is a horrific show, Jeff. You, when I tell you you're not missing anything, it's the reverse. I think you're gaining years on your life by not watching that big steaming pile of shit that's presented every Monday, because it's impossible to watch it. But Wednesday night, in my opinion, is the night for wrestling now, between NXT, which is putting forth quality matches, but the way that AEW is presented, it's exciting, it's vibrant. Yes, there's some stuff and that's mixed in there that is not great, but the great stuff, like blood on television, especially last night, you know, and as I'm watching that, and I'm assuming that Jericho blade, you saw it, am I correct, Jeff?
Yes, I did.
I'm assuming Jericho bladed, but he would have bladed, I guess, at the bridge of the nose, is my guess. It's hard for me to say, or was this hard way? I don't know, but I just thought it just looks so good. I really like what they're doing. You know, and I'm not the demographic. That's the important thing. I'm a solid 20 to 25 years past their core audience, but people seem to be liking it. And the people that are hoping that it fails, I'll never understand it, because I don't think, you know, Brian last, you know, there was, especially in the beginning, there was a lot of criticisms there, whether valid or not, and I don't know, but somebody posted a few minutes ago about talking about the Countdown to Revolution show last night and how good it was. And Brian last commented and said it was fantastic. They did a great job with it.
Yeah, so, no, there's no question about that. It was a very well done show.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, look, I get that people want to pick sides and shit, but at the end of the day, if you're a wrestling fan, you're a wrestling fan. And it looks like people that have been critical, whether it's Brian Last or Jim Cornette, they're able to see the positives in what's actually occurring, because there are positives and we're all fucking wrestling fans.
So a couple points real quick. I know you, Barry, since you've pointed out this particular issue, we're very disappointed that Chris Jericho did not get on the scale.
He looks a little better in the past week. I'm going to go out on a limb here, Jeff, and you and I have been watching wrestling when we were still virgins, which, you know, could
so just a couple months ago or what?
Yeah, exactly. Just be like a year or so ago. But in any case, based off of the show last night, I would say Moxley is probably winning that title. Moxley left in the ring, Chris Jericho standing on top of him with his foot on his chest or his back, standing there and just kind of flexing and raising the belt, which is an old school move, which says to me that Moxley might be winning the title this weekend.
Yeah. So another thing I wanted to mention was when I believe Dustin and
Jake Hager.
Jake Hager. Okay. We're having the brawl and they got near the Dippin' Dots. Okay. JR's line about, no, stay away from the Dippin' Dots. I popped so hard for that. Yes. That was so funny. And then when he throws him in the Dippin' Dots, JR goes, what did the Dippin' Dots ever do to anybody? Oh my God. That was
I liked it. Look, JR gets a lot of hate. Some of it may be valid too. I'm not going to dispute that. But at the same time, just like you, Jeff, I was laughing my ass off last night with that.
I will say the announcing with Taz is better. I like Taz as the third man in the group. You know, I don't have a lot of positive to say about Excalibur one way or the other, but Taz brings a certain, what's the word I'm looking for? A little energy, a little gravitas, you know? And so I like that inclusion. I think they did a good job. So Barry, it is now time. You sort of teased us with it a week or two ago. The fans have been clamoring. I've been getting phone calls, knocks on my front door. The dogs start barking. We want to hear Barry's New Mexico story. Barry, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I'm going to make this try to get a little creepy as I possibly can with this one. So
creepier than usual is what you mean,
which is really, when you stop and think about it, is pretty difficult. But I want to thank I think it was Brett Julian that wanted to hear the story. And then I believe it was James Winter that also chimed in, because James lived in New Mexico, may still live in New Mexico. And when we discussed on the Unsolved Mysteries, he was familiar with one of the victims. Did you happen to see that? I thought that was really interesting.
I did notice that. Yeah, that was kind of wild.
Yeah. So this goes back to, I guess this would have been May of 1985. And it was my first solo trip going from Miami, Florida to Los Angeles. And it's a hell of a trip if you've never gone cross country, and especially if you're going by yourself. And I was all of 21 years old, driving a bright red Camaro with Florida license plates during one of the heights of the cocaine era, without ever thinking about any of that, which, because I wasn't too bright then or too bright now. But yeah, so this was May of 1985, and I decided, I had a friend out in California, I had a place to stay, I had nothing keeping me in Florida, and I decided to go. So I made the trip. I spent, I think, my first night either in Mobile or Birmingham. This was and I throw this in because this was a fucking nightmare. So driving through the state of Florida is a nightmare. If you're in South Florida and you're trying to go out west, you have to go hundreds of miles straight up, and then you have to make a left and go another 100, 200, 300 miles. So getting out of Florida is a nightmare. So I forget what time I left. I'll say 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and I get to Birmingham or Mobile. I forget what time it is. I'm dead tired. I crash at some shitty fucking hotel. It just really disgusting. And I remember watching The Love Boat and Scarecrow and Mrs. King. And I fell asleep. And about 2:30, 3 a.m., all I'm hearing at that point, Jeff, was a fucking woodpecker right outside the room. So I do everything possible. I've got a pillow over my head. I'm doing everything. Nothing's working. I said, you know what? I'm going to get up and I'm going to get out of here. So I got in the car. It's probably 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And I started driving, and I'm going, you know, Alabama is not a bad state. I wind up, Mississippi's great, because Mississippi, you can do in an hour. Texas is the real nightmare, because Texas, you could take you a full day to get through. But I get to New Mexico. And so I'm in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and I'm staying at a hotel. I don't know if it's a Days Inn. I forget. I guess it was a Holiday Inn, because they actually had a restaurant there. And I remember going down to the restaurant. I got like the prime rib dinner. I think I even had a drink at that time. And I went upstairs. I went to sleep. And I guess I woke up also around 3:30, 4 o'clock. There was no woodpeckers or anything like that, but I couldn't sleep. And it's probably, I was anxious. So I get in the car and I start driving. And this was right in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And I'm driving, and I guess I'm in the car for maybe 20 minutes or a half an hour. And I guess it was I-10 that I was taking, which would have made sense. I-10, which is runs from the south to the west, north to east to the west. And I guess I'm 20, 25 minutes. It's pitch black. It's a little cold. And as I'm driving, I come upon, and I don't realize it, what it is, but it's some sort of a building. And there are three cops standing outside. And as they see me, they pull me over. So again, it's 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm probably not dressed appropriately. I'm probably wearing shorts and a t-shirt, even though it's cold out. But I'm in my car and I'm heated. It's the dead of night. So I pull over, and they're the three cops, border patrol agents, whatever they were. And the one guy says to me, goes, "Sir, where are you going?" I said, "Oh, I'm driving Florida to Los Angeles." Again, taking into account this is a bright red Camaro, relatively new as well, probably just 4, 5, 6 months old. And he says, "I'm going to need you to step out of the car." So I'm a little confused. You know, it's the middle of the night as well. A little confused as to why I'm being pulled over, because, you know, none of this is explained. And I step out, and they all three approach me and form a barrier between me and the car, which was seemed very odd at the time. And the one says to me, "What's the purpose of your trip?" And I said, "Well, I'm going out to, you know, stay with a friend. I'll be out there for, you know, 6, 7 months, whatever the time is." And he says, "Is there anything in the car that doesn't belong to you?" And I said, I don't know what you mean. And he said, you know, it's like, and I really didn't understand.
Other than the five bags of Coke? No.
Yeah, exactly. But I didn't understand what he meant by that. And he goes, "Is there anything in this car that you personally did not put in this car?" And I said, "No, I'm not aware of it." I said, "You know, this is my car, and everything in here is should be mine." And then he goes, "What's that perfume that I smell?" And I said, I'm wearing cologne. At that stage of my life, I think I was still wearing cologne. I said, "I'm wearing cologne."
He goes, "Aramis Therberry or what?"
I think it was like Royal Copenhagen.
Ooh, I used to use that. Royal Copenhagen was very nice.
Yeah, yeah, it was smooth. I haven't used cologne, which is obvious.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah, exactly. So then it gets a little more fun. Dracard Noir, that always raises red flags. And I think I did use Dracard after the Royal Copenhagen, Sweet Lou.
A little snobby, quite frankly. The Dracard Noir is kind of snobby. I wish you would have stayed with the Royal Copenhagen.
Yeah, well, I think as I was maturing, I was becoming exactly a little snobbier. So this is where it takes a little bit of a turn. So it's probably 45 degrees out. Again, I'm in shorts and a t-shirt. And the one guy asked, the one Border Patrol agent asked me to go stand up against the building facing the car with my back to the building. We're very direct about it as well. Again, I don't think I'd ever even been pulled over at this stage. So I'm a little like, what the fuck is going on here? And one of the guards comes and stands directly next to me. The two guys then proceed to go through my car. So I said to the one who's standing next to me, I said, "Man, it's cold out here." I said, "Do you have any idea how long this will take?" And he said, "Don't talk. Just stand there. Look straight ahead." At that point, Jeff, I realize I'm in the middle of the fucking desert. This building is in the middle of the desert. I'm like, these three cops are going to kill me. They're going to take me out to the desert. Nobody's ever going to discover me. They're going to take my car and they're going to just sell it for parts and take all the shit in my car. I was convinced I was going to die. So I try to maintain my composure. Again, I'm 21 years old, so I don't have any sort of reference on this whatsoever. And after about 20 or 25 minutes, the other two walk over, stand in front of me, essentially blocking my view of the car again, and said, are you positive that there is nothing in this car that you didn't personally put in?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am 100% positive." I think I actually did give him the 100% positive.
Did you say he was 100% correct?
No, I just said your mom is 100% positive with that one. And he then said, "Okay." He said, "You're free to go. Drive carefully." So I get in the car and I start driving, and I'm maybe a half a mile from the building, and I'm shaking. I'm literally shaking at this point. And right in front of me at that point, a jackrabbit runs out on the road, and I crush the jackrabbit. And I'm convinced at that point that I've just killed a creature, and these cops are now going to get in their car and they're going to come down and they're going to chase me down. And
that's a $100 fine in New Mexico, boy.
Exactly. And I hightailed it out of there, and I get out of there. But yeah, it was really scary. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that it was the middle of the night, the fact that I had no point of reference to anything that could happen, and the fact that they were essentially treating me as I was a criminal, even though I had done nothing wrong. And I didn't understand.
Says you.
It says me, absolutely. But I didn't understand at the time why they were even pulling me over until I got to LA and I told my friend, and he goes, dude, you're in a red fucking Camaro coming from Florida, coming out to California. They think you got coke on you.
Cocaine cowboy.
Exactly. So yeah, that's it. So maybe not as, but I got to admit, I was scared shitless.
You know, if you'd been driving the beige Toyota Corolla, chances are you probably wouldn't have gotten popped. So, you know.
Yeah, could have happened. But yeah, it's so that was it. And I made that trip probably four or five times over the
course. Oh, so it was a regular trip for you. Now yeah. That raises some questions.
And I think that, so to that point, Jeff, I may have left that out. I think that was also asked, but this being the first time, I said this is my first trip, which it was, but I never got pulled over again. That was the only time.
You know, I watched a movie about someone like you the other night, Barry, The Mule with Clint Eastwood. That's a pretty good movie, by the way. So next, Barry, we meant to do it last week. There was some sort of production values problem with Sweet Lou Kippelman. Now it's time to go to our little chat with our friend, the Tennessee stud, Ryan Fuller. Oh, Barry, if they could only hear the conversations we have before we begin to record. Once again, it's time for us to sit under the learning tree together as the Tennessee stud is joining us, Barry.
You know, this is real exciting for me, too. And you're right about that, Jeff, is that, A, we do learn, and you get to work with Ron on a weekly basis. Sweet Lou gets to work with Ron on a weekly basis. I listen to every episode, and Jeff, I'm not listening for you.
What?
Yeah, you find that hard to believe. I'm listening because the stud is on Ron Fuller, and this is to me so cool. We are running three different fan fests, Jeff, as you know, April 2nd, April 3rd, and April 4th of this year. During WrestleMania weekend, WrestleMania taking place in Tampa, and we were able to secure a room in arguably, and maybe it's not even arguable, Jeff, the most famous wrestling building, if not just the South, certainly the state of Florida. It's the old Fort Homer Hesterly Armory. Matches took place there for some 30 some odd years. Elvis played that building. There's a lot of history in that building. But when you say professional wrestling in the city of Tampa, immediately you're thinking of the old Fort Homer Hesterly Armory. And we were able to secure the services of the Tennessee stud, the man with the weekly stud cast, Ron Fuller. And Ron's going to be a part of two of our shows. The first one takes place on April the 2nd between 2:30 and 5:30. And we've secured six legends. Six guys who worked in that building multiple times, and six guys who know the wrestling business. So joining Ron Fuller will be Abdullah the Butcher, Buddy Cold, Bugsy McGraw will be there, Bill Alfonso, the Cuban Assassin, and rumor has it we may even have some additional names joining. But the big event that we're really looking at takes place on Saturday, April the 4th, starts at 3:30. And we're calling it, Jeff, The Great Debate. You've got Ron Fuller and Bob Roop, the former Olympian. And there's a lot of history there. All of our listeners have heard Bob on our show previously discussing this. Ron has been doing his studcast for several years now. He's talked at great lengths about what went down. But we're actually going to have Ron and Bob on a podium, on a dais, on stage, being able to discuss what went down. And, you know, Bob is adamant. He felt he was being cheated. Ron is adamant that, you know, these guys were basically trying to steal the territory. We're going to let them hash it out, Jeff. But having Ron today, I want to ask Ron a couple of questions before we get to the debate. Ron, what does it feel like and what does it mean to you to be able to get back into the old Fort Hesterly Armory one last time, a place where if I'm correct, one of your first matches took place back in the early 70s.
Right. I started in 1970 in Georgia and wrestled about 6 months before coming to Florida. The first Tuesday I was in Florida, I was on the card in Homer Hesterly Armory. In fact, my partner was Eddie Graham, and it was a six-man tag. I can't remember. My opponents were Dusty Rhodes, Dick Murdoch, and Tarzan Tyler. But Eddie Graham, and I can't remember who the other partner was. But I was young and green, and I didn't get to see that army for about a year, to be honest with you. I was a Fort Myers boy. After that, I got sent to Fort Myers, and I had to earn my way back to Tampa. But that is an extremely historic building. There's no doubt about it. One of the best wrestling arenas ever. A little warm in there. Didn't have any air conditioning. It's seen a lot of history, and some of it not all that good. You know, I mean, that happens to be where the window fell out on Eddie Graham, and he had a problem with his eye for the rest of his life. It was a great building to work in, and I got to work with some fine people there. In fact, I'll be honest with you, I won my first big time championship in that building, the Southern Heavyweight Championship, from Paul Jones in the Armory, by probably 1973. So it's a great place for wrestling fans. It's just there's so much history in that building.
Yeah, and so in looking at while you were talking, Ron, I actually pulled up my records on my computer, and the first match I have for you in Tampa would have been the 27th of October, 1970. Ron Fuller scheduled a team with Jose Lothario and Grizzly Smith, going by Jake Smith at that time, against Tarzan Tyler, Dick Murdoch, and Dusty Rhodes. Looks like you had done a couple of matches prior to that. Looks like I see one in Orlando and one in Hollywood as well. That is the first one that I'm seeing right there. But that building holds so much history for professional wrestling. You and Buddy Colt, and Buddy will be there on the second. You and Buddy Colt had some real brawls in that building as well, if I'm correct.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for the Florida championship, when Buddy was Florida champion. And I finally won that championship from him. But I think it was in Miami where I won that one. But that building has a lot of memories for me. And I'm just excited to be a part of that.
And we're definitely excited to have you. So the big event, and then this is something I remember when I originally was thinking about this, and I was hesitant to approach you. It was really funny, Ron, because I have a lot of respect for you. It's you've always treated me fantastic. And I was like, you know, if I go to Ron with this and I say, Ron, would you be interested in debating Roop? Is he going to feel that I'm insulting him? So I think I was nervous for a couple of weeks when I had to approach you. But with all that said, I'm so excited for this event, and I know that the fans are as well. People have been reaching out to me and are like, you know, there are people coming strictly into Tampa, not to see WrestleMania, but to see you on stage to have this conversation with Bob. So leading up to this, you know, what's going through your mind? What's your thought process?
Well, you know, fans probably won't believe this, but I have not spoken to Bob Roop in 40 years, since 1979, probably May of 1979. So it's going to be a little bit of a different deal. I mean, I have kind of set things straight, and I feel comfortable with others that were involved, but I have never talked to Bob Roop about it. And I've never actually forgiven him, you know, and I really don't know how this is going to go or how it's going to end. But, you know, it's probably something that needs to be done. And I think it'll be a very interesting conversation and a debate for those that come and see it, because we're two quite different people, Bob and I.
Yeah, which that's probably a very safe way to put that. You guys very, very different with that too. Did you have a relationship with Bob, and I would say a personal relationship or a friendship with Bob prior to what happened in 1979?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You
Bob
did.
And
okay.
Bob and I were in the Snake Pit, the old office, the Sportatorium office on 106 North Albany there, two, sometimes three times a week shooting with each other. Way back in the early 70s, 70, 71, 72. So we have history. And in that same building that I was shooting with Matsuda, Jack Briscoe was in there some. It was not a pleasant place for guys that thought they were wrestlers or wanted to be wrestlers to show up at. But we went in there, and when there weren't guys that Eddie wanted us to deal with, then we basically shot with each other. And Bob and I were friends. We were friends in the early 70s for sure.
Wow. So what is your, as you walk into the building on April the 4th, and again, this is the Great Debate, Bob Roop, Ron Fuller, Saturday, April the 4th, 3:30 to 6:30. What's going to be going through your head?
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing the old army. For one thing, it's been, gosh, I actually left in 1974 and started my first territory. Southeastern in Knoxville. So I haven't been in that building since 74. So there'll be a lot of memories that'll come back pretty quickly, I'm sure. I haven't seen it. I hear that they've really done some work on it. It's a little bit of a different structure than what it used to be. But as far as the debate itself, I'm kind of torn there. I don't know how to picture what this is going to be like. But it's probably something that needs to be done. Probably should have done it a long time ago. I have just in this past year, well, actually in the past 2 years, kind of settled the score with Ronnie Garvin, you know, and also with Bob Orton Jr. I wasn't able ever to do anything so far as with the great Malenko because he passed before that was possible. And Ron Wright and I settled our differences years back in the late 80s, 87, 88, when I started my fourth wrestling company, USA Championship Wrestling. So you know, this is something that probably needs to be done. And the way I look forward to it, and in other ways, I don't know what to expect.
Gotcha. My last question. So Bob was recently on the David Penzer podcast. Jeff, how many listeners does David Penzer get on a weekly basis?
Hold on. Let me check my figures right now. 7 million and counting.
Wow. That's absolutely yes. Huge. But
he has more than Jericho and Austin combined. That's what I hear.
Wow. Which is huge. Considering he does zero promotion for the show. But so Bob Roop was recently on, and Ron, I know that you had a chance to listen to the majority of what Bob had to say. And I think he discussed Knoxville and the situation the last 20 or 25 minutes. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's kind of what I expected that his take would be on it. You know, he's always, he from the very beginning thought that there was some stealing going on with ticket sales I have my own reasoning that wasn't the case. But, you know, like I said, once it actually started and the opposition started and they started to run the town the next night after I ran in the Coliseum, they would run in Chilhowee Park, which was a little small park there in the city of Knoxville. That's where they would have their matches. And it was, for me, the most difficult summer of my wrestling career, 1979, because of having that problem. And probably it bothered me a lot because I cared for those guys, Ronnie Garvin, Ron Wright in particular, because they had worked for me for many, many years in Southeastern there. So, you know, this will be interesting. It'll be as interesting for me as it'll probably be for fans, to be quite honest with you.
Wow. Well, Ron, I know that I appreciate your time today. Thank you for coming on and discussing this with us. Jeff, any final words for the stud?
Yeah, I have a quick question, Ron. So you talked about the snake pit. You talked about Hiro Matsuda, yourself, Jack Briscoe, Bob Roop, and I'm sure there were other guys. Was there of the group of guys that went to the snake pit? And maybe the answer to this is yourself, but was there one guy that you would sit there and look at and go, yeah, that guy, I don't want to get that guy agitated at me.
Well, you know, to be quite honest with you, when Jack Briscoe came in, he had no peer. I guess that's a good way of putting it.
No, and that might be the answer.
You know, I mean, Jack to me was one of the greatest wrestlers, pure wrestlers of all time. And his style was catch as catch can. I mean, he did not, he was not a hooker or a shooter, as I call him. He had that tremendous amateur background, lost one match, I believe, in his entire amateur career, and just was phenomenal wrestler. But he was always intrigued with the guys that knew how to hurt people. And he wanted to see it. He wanted to learn it, you know. When we started one-on-one with each other, there was nobody above Jack. He was at the top.
Okay, so fair answer. We appreciate that. We appreciate your time with us, Ron. Barry, one last time, a little plug for the date again.
Absolutely. So it is going to be April 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, the events that Ron is on. And this will also, Jeff, we should say too, it is a meet and greet as well, where, you know, there'll be photos taken and autographs signed. It is April 2nd, 2:30 to 5:30, and then April 4th, 3:30 to 6:30 in Tampa, Florida. Tickets are available. You can go to our page, which is the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Facebook group. You can also check us out, CWF Legends Fan Fest Facebook group, or the Championship Wrestling Archives Facebook group as well, Jeff.
All right, Ron, once again, buddy, we appreciate you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, guys.
Okay, Barry, always good to talk to the stud, especially when you're promoting the upcoming CWF Legends Fan Fest. Why don't you give us the specs on that again, Bear?
Yeah, too. What a great guy Ron Fuller is. And
absolutely.
Also, let me fully apologize to Mark Hertweck, who reached out to me this week and said, did I miss Ron Fuller? Did I fall asleep during the podcast? I said, no, Ron's on there. Mark, I owe you an apology. Ron was not on there. We did tape it, but he's obviously on this episode. But it is coming up. It is April the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. Three different fan fests. The big one that we're all looking forward to takes place on April the 4th, which is a Saturday, taking place in the old Fort Homer Hesterly Armory, now the Brian Glazer Family JCC. 3:30 to 6:30, it's the big debate. Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, meeting his old nemesis, Bob Roop. They will discuss the attempted takeover and all the shit that went down in Knoxville some 40 years ago. Very excited, but we're doing FanFest. Buddy Colt, Kevin Sullivan, Maha Singh, Bugsy McGraw, Abdullah the Butcher, a host of talent will be there. You can get tickets by going to CWF Legends Fan Fest. We have a Facebook page. I also post links in the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry group. But we're real excited about this one, Jeff. This is a big deal. The most historic venue for wrestling in the state of Florida and arguably the South. So for me, it's kind of a dream come true in a lot of ways.
And in fact, do you not have an update on the Abdullah the Butcher appearance?
Jeff, you are really on top of things.
Boom! It's
all this time spent on the bowl this week. Am I right?
there's the listener image of the day.
Yep. You got the phone in your hand. You've got the Ethiopians flowing through and you're like, yes. So I don't know exactly the details, or I should say I'm probably not authorized to share those details.
Well, I'm sorry I mentioned it then.
Yeah, no, but I can't share the details of why he's not going to be at WrestleCon. Something happened, but he was scheduled to be there. So our appearance with Abdullah the Butcher, and Abdullah he's late 70s, maybe even 80 years old at this point. I don't know how many more appearances Abdullah is going to be making. This is an exclusive appearance. And I should say too, Jeff, I am going to break kayfabe.
What?
Yes, we are going to have a private dinner with Abdullah. It will be taking place in a restaurant. It is
Chinese food and ribs.
So we thought about it. We actually thought about that, but we're actually in negotiations with the restaurant right now. It was a place that was recommended by somebody within the area. We checked it out and we like it, but we are going to be hosting a private dinner with Abdullah the night of the Fan Fest, which would be April the 2nd. Limited to only 20 fans in the restaurant. You'll sit at the table with Abdullah. You'll get to watch Abdullah eat which is probably, it'll be raw chicken for Abdullah. Exactly. I don't even know if he even has teeth, so he might be gumming his food. So this could be, this is not something you're going to want to miss.
It's right a different here. Way of watching Abby work with a fork than usual. There,
yes. And we're actually looking at that. I believe everybody attending the dinner is going to get an autographed fork from Abdullah as well. So we're very
priceless
excited.
Priceless memento. That.
Absolutely. And for an additional $5, he'll even jab it into your forehead and draw blood. So,
okay. So before we go to the match of the week, Barry, I do want to have one little sad note. We recently found out that Rip Oliver is the crippler is in hospice. And why don't you give us some details on that?
Yeah. So he did our last fan fest in June. We did one in November, but he did the one in June and was supposed to be there with Billy Jack Haynes. At this point, I think everybody knows the story of why Billy Jack wasn't there, but Rip came, didn't come for a lot of money, could not have been any more gracious, friendly, came in a suit, was well-dressed, and just a gentleman, just a really, really stand-up, sweet guy. It was obvious he wasn't in the best of health, but I was so happy that he was able to be there, and I think he had a great time. He doesn't do a lot of these. And word reached out over the last 48 hours that Rip had entered hospice with heart failure and was not expected to live much longer. And it's really sad because he really was a gentle soul. You know, this was a guy was a great heel in professional wrestling. But in real life, this is a guy I think that was just a gentle soul. And Billy Jack Haynes gets beaten up a lot, and it may be deserved or not. I'll let you determine that. But Billy Jack apparently has been by Rip's side throughout this and has not left his side and apparently will not leave his side until Rip passes on. So that's commendable. I think we all need a friend like that. So kudos to Billy Jack and Rip Oliver. I don't think he ever really truly got his due in professional wrestling. Certainly did in the Pacific Northwest out in Portland. But this guy probably should have had a bigger career. And it might have been, if I was going to look at it, you know, and I'm going off of what we saw in Florida and maybe other places, maybe because his personality was a little toned down, because he really is kind of a gentle, calmer guy. But his work in the ring, I always thought could hold up to anybody. Solid guy. Thank you for the memories. And I hope that your journey is a peaceful and painless one, Rip. Thank you.
Rip Oliver from Old Homosassa.
Yeah. And, which was a shoot. Yeah. That was a shoot.
And he worked a few gimmicks in Florida, didn't he? I know he was the Gestapo.
So he started off, he was Rick Oliver, which I believe is his given name, which is Richard Oliver. And then he became the Gestapo, which is a gimmick.
Gimmicks that could not be used today, by the way.
Yeah, it was, especially Miami Beach, of all places.
Yeah, right.
I think he was even the Samurai briefly. He was aligned with Tiger Hattori and Tenryu and those guys. I think he did that shortly. And then became the crippler Rip Oliver. And there could be another gimmick or two thrown in there. But again, just a solid, solid worker. And if you've ever seen his Portland stuff where he was allowed to shine, he's as good as anybody out there.
Yeah. And I'm sure that when Kevin Orcutt hears this, I would invite him to find your favorite Rip Oliver match, Kevin, and post it within our group. Because as Barry said, a very solid worker. A guy that was aligned quite a while with Buddy Rose. And it's always fun to see Buddy Rose stuff in our group. So now it is time, Barry, to go to our match of the week. We are looking at January 4th, 1994, Pikeville, Kentucky. The card, the Bluegrass Brawl, was subtitled The Famous Final Scene. So I want to tell you really quick, a quick story about what happened here, about us choosing this match. So we had picked a match out, or I had picked a match out and sent it to Barry. And then when I started watching the match, I went, yeah, you know, I think we've done this match before. I mean, come on, folks. It's 126 episodes. That has to happen sooner or later. And so Barry goes, yeah, I think we have done this match already. And so I decided, you know what? I don't know that we've ever done a Smoky Mountain match. Maybe we did once or twice, but I couldn't remember. So I was trying to think. I said, who can I reach out to? You know, I'm going to reach out to the man that I call the original BM, speaking of Ethiopian food, my man Bruce Mitchell. I said, Bruce, if you had to pick one Smoky Mountain match to watch or to recommend to somebody, what would you choose? And he chose this match, and he had a great reason for choosing this match. He said, I did an interview with Jimmy Del Rey, one of the Heavenly Bodies, and he was telling me about this match, and he said, at the end of the match, the pop from the crowd at the finish of the match was so great, quote, I got an erection. And I said, that's good enough for me. We're watching this match. So, Barry, tell us what you thought about this match.
Yes, and I want everybody that is going to watch this match, as you're watching it, just remember Bruce Mitchell got an erection.
No, no, not Bruce Mitchell. Jimmy Del Rey got an erection.
Oh.
From the reaction of the crowd. I don't want to besmirch the good name of Bruce Mitchell here.
No, and rest in
peace. We'll besmirch that later.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And Jimmy Del Rey no longer with us, so I won't make any jokes here. But this is a very good match. And what I liked about this match, probably more than anything else, there were two things. One, it's a big match feel. You can tell there is a buzz in the crowd. There is a lot of electricity that's going on with this. This is also a longer match than we normally record, Jeff, which is my fault because I don't like a lot of the longer matches. I have the attention.
Thanks for nothing, Barry.
Exactly. Give me a solid 8-minute match and I'm thrilled. But this one is, I think the video is 33 minutes from start to finish. And the first lockup doesn't occur into 7.5 minutes into the match. But it works. You know, this is what it's about. There is drama. And by the time the first Heavenly Body and the first Rock and Roll Express actually lock up, you know, the crowd is just eating this up. So I really like that aspect of it. The cage is used. Pritchard is the first one to actually get some juice. And it's textbook. He gets slammed into the cage. He bounces back. He goes mid-ring. He lies face first on the mat, covering up. You know exactly what's going on. But a lot of times, I don't think the cage was overused. You know, it wasn't where they were using the cage for every spot or something like that. And I think a lot of it was designed to keep Cornette out, would be my assumption with it. One thing popped into my head as I was watching this too, Jeff. How aware were the wrestling fans that Jim Cornette was the owner, a part owner of SMW?
I think they always referred to like a shadow owner who was Rick Rubin. So I don't really think they knew that.
Right. I know it was never announced.
Oh, no, not at all.
Yeah. But I just wonder if there was this chatter within the arenas, you know, fans before the matches start will always bullshit. Somebody had to have known that Cornette was the owner. Somebody,
so you're trying to say there was an observer reader in Pikeville, Kentucky back then?
Yeah, that's what that or a torch reader or something like that. You know, there,
or
I don't,
a chair
internet.
Shots reader, maybe. Hey.
You know, it could have been. Absolutely. 94, it could have been. I don't think the internet was, you know, was super strong in 94. It was kind of the burgeoning of the internet. But this match, what I liked about it, it tells a story. There's no rushing of anything. Great teamwork from both of these guys. Gibson wraps Del Rey up with the Gibson leg lock. Pritchard then rams Mark Curtis into the steel cage to prevent the count. This was a loser leaf town match, so there was a lot riding on it, obviously. But the Rock and Roll Rebound, they hit a great double drop kick. You know, the joke has always been that they missed. But this one looks like it really connects. Rookie referee, and he's referred to rookie referee, Brian Keyes comes in. They probably call him the rookie referee 5 or 10 times. And Jeff, I'll let you wrap up the finish on this, but I will tell you what I liked about this match was what took place afterwards. And there is a video. It's an interview with Cornette that takes place with the Smoky Mountain Board of Directors. Jeff, have you seen this?
I have not.
Oh, my God.
Or if I did see it, it was years ago.
This beats the match, in my opinion. So this must have aired on television, and it's an interview with Cornette and the Heavenly Bodies, and they walk out of a room. Now, this is taking place in the local high school, first off, which is, I mean, to me, it looks like it's the lunch cafeteria, which I just think is the greatest thing ever. And Cornette cuts a promo that is, I think it's one of the better Cornette promos. He's not over the top. He's expressing his disappointment with the situation. The glasses are off. He looks like he's going to be in tears. Little more subdued, though. I think this is one of the best of all time. And he's talking about that he may just leave Smoky Mountain Wrestling as well. They start to walk away. Cornette stays. The Heavenly Bodies start to walk away. Jimmy Del Rey is having a breakdown of sorts. He's crying. And they're playing a Bob Seger song to this as they walk away. And it's a slow walk. And there's so much going on here. It's The production is not, you know, this is single camera shit. Cornette's promo, the song, the walking down the hall. Everyone's performing here tremendously. They hug each other goodbye. Del Rey acting mad and then having to be consoled. The announcer, who was that announcer? Who's the announcer?
Chip
for
Kessler.
Yeah, you know, there's good and bad to Chip. He brings a small town vibe. Let's put it that way. He never could have made it on the big screen, but it works. This works for what it's happening. And this is the blow off. This is it. I love it. Search out not just the match. And Jeff, you've got to see this promo, but search out this video. It's a solid 5 minutes because it's, to me, it's just fantastic. You get a big thumbs up for me. Invest some time in this. Between the match and the promo, it's probably 40 minutes, but you'll like it. It's got this great old territory vibe. Even though it's only 25, 26 years old, it certainly seems like something that would have come from the 70s, Jeff.
So I'm guessing, since you said it was a Bob Seger song and the name of the card was a famous final scene, that was the song that was doing the playoff as they walked out of the building. Well, let's talk about some stuff here real quick. Third man in the ring was referee Mark Curtis, who was Brian Hildebrand, well-known amongst a lot of longtime wrestling fans, who has left us. I never met him, but by all accounts was a really, really good guy. Did you ever meet Brian?
Many times. So Brian was part of the old Wrestling Fans International Association, and I met Brian at several of the conventions, which is, I think, where the friendship between Cornette and Brian actually formed. At one of those shows right there. So he was a great guy, loved the wrestling business, you know, small framed, wasn't going to be a wrestler, but just lived and breathed for professional wrestling. And we lost him at such a young age from cancer. Yeah. You know, he was such a young guy.
So as you said, Chip Kessler on the call of the match, I liked one of his early hyperboles. He said, Ricky and Robert have said that if they lose tonight, they will retire. And by the way, what was up with the, I know this is really ridiculous. The coat that Robert started wearing at this point, he was wearing this long drape coat like Ron Bass and Black Bart used to wear, except he had all these things stitched into it, like these different logos and things. I just thought it was, you know, they'd gone from like the guys who would wear the colorful T-shirts to guys who are now wearing the long drape coats. It was the older Rock and Roll Express. The crowd is, no question, is on fire, not just for the intros, but during the entire match, they just... Holy cow, they were so into this match. And, you know, we've said it 1,000 times here, but the crowd being into a match like this crowd was just makes the match so much more fun to watch. Chip Kessler mentioning that if either the Rock and Roll Express or the Heavenly Bodies were to lose, that other groups are salivating about the possibility of these tag teams coming in. He mentioned Vince McMahon Jr. and Eddie Marlin have been negotiating to have these two teams come in if they lose. It was about 9 minutes in that Tom Pritchard was the first one to get the color. I liked it. Chip Kessler, somebody hit a DDT. I think it was maybe Tom Pritchard. And he said, that is a modified pile driver. That's a great word in wrestling with wrestling announcers, modified. Because whenever they don't know the name of the hold or they draw a blank on it, they call it modified. Yeah? That's a modified body slam.
Right.
You know, but let's see, 20 minutes in, that's when Mark Curtis gets thrown into the cage by Jimmy Del Rey. Jimmy Del Rey does a moonsault on Ricky Morton. That's a great false finish at the 23-minute mark. The rookie referee goes to hit a three count. Brian Curtis stops him right at 2 in a really well-timed maneuver. Then Jimmy Del Rey goes to hit a powerbomb on Ricky Morton. It's reversed. 24 minutes in, the Rock and Roll gets the win. And Jim Cornette comes into the ring, lays on the mat, and begins to have his tantrum. Really good stuff. Meltzer, I did the research on it, the quality research that apparently is not done on our Unsolved Mysteries episode, Barry. The quality research shows that Dave Meltzer, 4.5 stars, which in 1994, that was pretty damn good. There was no 7-star matches in 1994, I don't think. So this, to me, Barry, was like a very old-fashioned Southern match. Unfortunately, those kind of matches have been lost to history. So that's, if nothing else, a reason. There was no, you know... lots of crazy maneuvers. This was just a fight. And the kind of stuff you would see in Memphis and in Nashville and Kentucky you know, the stuff, the Memphis territory or the Carolinas, Southern style tag team matches with lots of fights, lots of different stuff going on. The finish was really well timed because right as Ricky reversed it, Robert, who was tied to the ropes, gets loose and blocks Tom Pritchard from preventing the fall. So really well done finish, I thought, Barry.
Yeah, I thought the finish was great too. And it's that's the thing with this match. There is no spot here other than maybe the Gibson leg lock, which I liked. But there's no one spot that you're going to go, holy shit, did they just do that? It's not. It's just a solid worked match. But the drama that's built up, and again, the fans are so vested into this, it makes it really exciting. But I did truly enjoy it. And again, Jeff, you got to check out this video that was shot in the local high school.
Yes, and if we get that video, I will post that video along with the match on our Facebook group, Breaking KB with Brother and Barry. Okay, Barry, before we get to our top 1,000 songs discussion, I know that you have recently returned from Sin City, the place where what happens there stays there. Tell the folks about your trip to Las Vegas. Did you go to the Fury Wilder fight while you were there? I'm sure you would have got front row tickets with your connections.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, too. And I actually showed up the day after the fight, so I was able to miss part of that. But it was my first time back in Vegas in probably about 2 or 3 years. It was work-related, but I did have some free time involved. And most of my free time in Vegas is either going to be spent looking for quality meals or visiting one of their multiple dispensaries. But I did have some fantastic meals in the city. And I know Sweet Lou is headed out to CAC for Cauliflower Alley Club and headed out to Vegas, I guess, in April. I think we're maybe less than 2 months away for this. And I may actually try to join Lou out there because, A, I do want to meet Sweet Lou, but I also want to be able to go to In-N-Out Burger with Sweet Lou. I think that would be a lot of fun. So let's do a little recap on the food situation here. I did hit In-N-Out Burger twice, Jeff, and I did.
You made us proud, Bear.
I did 2 lunches out there. They've got a couple of locations, actually several locations, but it was as solid as it's ever been. I got the same thing, which is the number one. I got fries animal style once and one time without, but I love In-N-Out. You know what? It's to me, it is so solid.
Who does not love a little bit of the old In-N-Out?
There are a couple of people that have posted, and I fully get that I buy into the cult of In-N-Out.
Oh, you were talking about burgers. I'm sorry. I was.
Ah, a little double entendre there.
A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. But solid as could be. I stayed at Caesar's Palace. It is right across the street in the Link Complex. And I got to say, as usual, food comes out. It's hot. Food is delicious. And as we are recording, I have not had lunch and I'm now starving. But thrilled that I was able to go to In-N-Out. And of course, I got the proverbial T-shirt, as I do every time I visit one of their locations. It's a shirt that I did not have previously. So super excited. But 3 restaurants I went to, which are, I don't know if Lou's ever been to these. I know he's been to In-N-Out. One is Giordano's, Jeff. So Giordano's is the Chicago deep dish pizza chain. And it's fantastic. I've gotten it in Chicago. But there is a location in the Kissimmee area right near Disney World, and I've eaten there. And I think that was actually the first one I ever ate at. And it's phenomenal. It takes anywhere between 30 to 45 minutes to actually get your pizza. It's a deep dish pizza. They make it fresh for you and they cook it fresh. And it literally takes upwards of 45 minutes. It's fantastic. So when I saw that there was a Giordano's, I was making every effort to get there. Loved it. It's as fantastic as ever. Went to Rao's. Rao's is a very popular high-end Italian restaurant in New York City. For years, the rumor was it was mob-owned and still may be. I don't know.
Allegedly.
Am I going to be taken to task for saying allegedly? Greenbaum?
Yeah. Puff, I said it.
All right. Greenbaum giving me a lot of shit this week for Essa Bagel, allegedly, for calling Sweet Lou to verify. He had a whole list of gripes that he put forth right there, which I actually got the biggest kick out of.
I know we spend a lot of time worrying about Greenbaum's critiques.
Oh, without Jeff, we wouldn't exist if we didn't have Greenbaum critiquing us. You know that. But I was able to go to Rao's, and it was a meal that was absolutely 100% correctly one of the best meals I've had in a long time. I got the penne alla vodka, which was their version of it. Have you ever tried the Rao's sauce, Jeff? You can buy it in the grocery stores.
I have seen it, but I've never tried it.
It's pricey in the grocery store. I want to say it goes somewhere between $7 to $10 a jar, which really seems pricey. We get the double combo pack from Sam's Club, and I believe it's $5 a jar then. And we stopped making homemade sauce. My betrothed, the lovely Mrs. Rose, and I used
the long suffering Mrs. Rose.
Boy, Jeff, no truer words have ever been spoken, and you'd be absolutely correct about that. 100%.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Yes.
Check more. That box off.
Yep. Check it off for this show. But we used to make our own sauce, which was a really labor intensive process of cutting up vegetables and stewing to, you know, doing everything that goes along with it. We now just buy the Rao's and just add a little something to it. And it's phenomenal. I highly recommend, but it was great. I had a great dinner that night. But my first dinner in Vegas was spent with Roman Gomez. So Roman is the co-host along with Mike Sempervive of the fantastic Mid-Atlantic podcast that is airing here on the Arcadian Vanguard Network. And Roman and I have been friends for, I'll say, the last 6 months, maybe a year. You also may remember Roman from one of his appearances on the 605. He was the unfortunate fellow that had his
Dory Funk Jr. issue.
Same guy. So, he's got, and here's the thing about Roman. He's got such a great, attitude about it. He's kind of low key. He wasn't, if that had been me, I'd be spewing forth venom. And Roman's just like, yeah, it happened, whatever. He's okay about it. But we've been talking, and he was inviting me out for dinner, and we made plans. So we hit up Bobby Flay's Mesa Grill, which is one of the multitude of restaurants in Caesar's Palace. And Roman reminds me of you, Jeff. He's the kind of meat and potatoes kind of eater, and where I'm a little more adventurous. So Roman got the filet. I got the, Southwest veal chop and Brussels sprouts. Fucking unbelievable. The veal chop cooked absolutely perfect at about a medium. I just destroyed this thing, but it was great. We sat, we talked for a couple of hours. We talked about everything. We talked about wrestling and our podcast, but it was kind of cool. We had a guy sitting next to us, and I'll say this guy was 70 years old without knowing how old he was. And he overheard us talking about wrestling, and he goes, "Hey, I hate to interrupt." And he must have said, "I hate to interrupt" four or five times. And he kept interrupting. We didn't mind, though. And he had grown up in Detroit and had gone to Cobo and was rattling off the Sheik and Ernie Ladd and Leaping Larry Shane and just a whole bunch of guys, and had all these great memories. And it was amazing, because at one point I looked over at this guy's wife and I said it. I said, "Ma'am, you have the exact same look that my wife gets when wrestling is being discussed." Because she was clearly, it was a cross between she's on another planet and she's irritated. You know, she's completely zoned, yet can we shut the fuck up? But it was great being able to talk with this guy. But Roman and I, good friends, we had a great dinner at Bobby Flay's. And Sweet Lou, are you there, Sweet Lou?
Yes, I am.
Lou, when you go out to Vegas, because you like to eat as well, food is an important component of what you do.
What are you trying to say about Lou?
I'm trying to say that.
Nothing that isn't already widely known if anybody sees photos of me.
I'm not trying to say that, we can certainly talk about that, but I'm not trying to say that. What I'm trying to say is Vegas offers this, as far as eating, there are few cities that I think have the wide variety that Vegas has. And a lot of it has to do with anybody that has a restaurant in another city, Rao's being a great example. They want to, and Giordano's, they want to bring this concept to Vegas based off the tourism. So, look, my hotel's got a Joe's Stone Crab. It had a Hell's Kitchen from Gordon Ramsay. There are so many, choices. But Lou, being somebody who enjoys food as much as I do, because I love food, what are you looking forward to when you get out there? Where do you want to eat? What have you got your eye on?
Oh, boy. I can't say that I've been doing reconnaissance on the dining options.
Lucky for you, Barry has been.
Yes. I've stayed at the Gold Coast before, and the Gold Coast is the host hotel for CAC. The dining options there, I don't know. I'm not exactly thrilled by any of them. It's right near the Rio, and the Rio has a history of having good dining options, like their seafood buffet and whatnot. Yeah, I mean, I am a gourmand, but I I haven't been thinking about it with this. I've been thinking about what happens when I meet Hannibal.
Well, Lou, I hope to be right beside you when we do see Hannibal. And because if, you know, Hannibal, who's not a fan of me, which is very hard to believe.
No.
If Hannibal goes to punch me, slam me physically to give me the lariat, I do need somebody there to be able to capture this, Lou. So I will be right by your side. But hopefully we can hit In-N-Out Burger or, you know, or several meals. And Neely Shockett, I bet, will be there with us as well.
Neely will step right in and he will have your back, Barry.
Yes.
There's a throwdown. Neely's jumping right in the middle of it.
He strikes me as that kind of guy that is a very loyal friend that that probably would have your back in some form.
So, Howard Baum would walk to the other side of the room.
And he'd make a snarky comment as he
exactly.
did.
Exactly. He's well known yes. for snarky comments. So yep. One last question about Vegas, Barry, since I haven't sure. been out there in a while. Best breakfast buffet when my wife and I were out there was Mandalay Bay. Would you say that's still the truth?
So I got to be honest, I don't know. My company provided a breakfast buffet every day, so I took advantage of that. I will say where Lou just said about seafood buffet, the hotel in the Caesars had a seafood buffet with gigantic snow crab claws. I think there was Alaskan king crab claws. I kind of screwed up. I wanted to hit that and I didn't because I could charge the company for that dinner, and I didn't do that, and I probably should have. But there are breakfast buffets. Do you like a good breakfast buffet, Jeff?
When I'm in Vegas, I certainly do. I'm not going to Shoney's regularly, but
Shoney's.
That's an old school reference right there.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, okay, Barry, we appreciate that Vegas food update. I have to check out the how do you say it? Rao's,
yeah, you gotta try that sauce. Yeah,
I have to get my wife to get that sauce for the next time we have the skits or something. So, so now it's time for us to look at our list of the top 1,000 songs as listed by SiriusXM's. I don't know, they did their top 1,000 classic rock songs. They played them over the course of a couple of weeks, which is actually kind of nice because you could be getting in the car now at number 563, and you know, chances are you were going to get a halfway decent song going on there. So I have to be honest with you at this point in the show. Here's a real big news flash. We're not going to be going through all 1,000 songs. First of all, because I think Barry and I would kill ourselves. But we want to just discuss a few of the problems that we have with the list and the immortal words of Frank Costanza. I got a lot of problems with you people. Barry, you ready to take a look at this list?
Yeah, we do have a lot of problems with you. I like that.
And let's start right away. 1,000, Barry, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Long Time Gone. It's a great song. And immediately... and number 999, Van Halen, Best of Both Worlds. You sit there and immediately say to yourself, are there really 1,000 songs better than Long Time Gone or Best of Both Worlds? What do you think?
Yeah, Best of Both Worlds, I think, is a very good Van Halen song. It, you know, 999, that's really tough. How do you, this is the other thing that I think of when I see a list of this size. I could see doing a list of the top 25, 50, maybe even 100 songs.
Absolutely.
How the fuck do you compile a list of the top 1,000 songs of all time?
And that is the biggest problem I have with this, because as I mentioned at the opening of the show, I'm sure there are deep tracks, Led Zeppelin, Hendrix, whoever, that are great songs. And people that I know that are music snobs, that's right, you know who I'm talking about, they're going to go, oh, yeah, these songs, they're way better than Purple Haze or Stairway to Heaven or something like that. But, you know, I'm sitting here looking at this and I'm going, how about a song that's been played on the fucking radio within the last 20 damn years? Okay, because right now, okay, number 990, Spirit, I got a line on you. First of all, okay, excuse me, I've never heard of that song. And guess what? I can't recall hearing that song on the radio in the last 25 fucking years. So I don't understand how that song... is more highly regarded than Best of Both Worlds or Long Time Gone, which I've heard on the fucking radio, which I think is the whole point of this damn list, Barry. I'm just getting started.
Jeff, can I back up just a little bit to, yeah, I want to back up to 994. Now I've talked about U2. I'm not a fan of U2, but some songs that they have are better than others. As with every band. Somehow, 994 is Angel of Harlem, which is maybe one of my least favorite songs in the history of music. I have no idea how that's on there right there. 990 Spirit, I Got a Line on You. I agree with you. It's a great song, but you know, when was the last time you heard it?
Exactly. So we're going to jump around a little bit here, folks. And I'll post this whole list so the folks can go through it and offer their own critiques. So okay, here's another one. 980, Sammy Hagar. I know they're very polarizing as the leader of Van Halen, but on his own, There's Only One Way to Rock is 980. Okay. So you're telling me that song, which is a staple of classic rock radio, that there are 979 songs that are better or more important in rock history than that song? I don't understand that. It's 979 Kiss, Shout It Out Loud. Good Lord, that song's on the radio every fucking day. This is what my friend Howard Baum would definitely say is a mark list. And when we get to the very top of the list, Howard will go, oh, it's definitely a mark list. So I understand that. But, you know, there are songs that are like at number 500 or 520. And you sit there and you go, really? That song's better or more well thought of than Shout Out Loud? That, you know, again, these are songs that are staple of classic rock radio. I don't understand how these songs get in there. 975, Bruce Springsteen, Badlands. Look, I understand a lot of people don't like Bruce Springsteen. But Badlands, that's a staple of classic rock radio, Barry.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, but look, even going 972, the Who, The Kids Are All Right. 972 out of 1,000 songs.
But 964, Ziggy Stardust by Bowie.
Yeah, and I was going to go two right below that. 966, Patience by Guns N' Roses. Everybody loves that song, except for people listening to this show right now, I bet.
Or people that hate Axl Rose. That could also do it. 960, Thunder Road. That song's on classic rock radio literally every day. I don't. And here's something that really just cheesed me off, okay? I'm a big fan of The Clash, okay? 955, London Calling by The Clash, as opposed to 932, which is Great White, Once Bitten, Twice Shy. Are you fucking kidding me, people?
Yeah, you know what? At this point, I'm ready just to fucking scrap this segment and just say this should go literally. Absolutely go.
Say it because there is nothing people in our group like more than a good music argument.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. But, you know, so London Calling is 955. London Calling, which is, I mean, you know, what that album and song represents for that genre and that time period is, it's, you know, but Space Cowboy by Steve Miller Band, 951. And then worse, Jay Giles Band, Give It To Me at 946 is ranked higher than The Clash, London Calling. What?
Yeah, you know, I don't understand it. And what gets me also, Barry, 937 Van Halen Right Now. I really like that video. Do you remember that video?
Yeah.
Where they were holding up the signs. Yeah, that's a good song. Yeah. So Jailbreak by Thin Lizzy, 912. There are 911 songs that are better than Jailbreak by Thin Lizzy. I don't think so. So here's a discussion, Barry, that I want to have as part of the list here. People that are on this list that I don't consider classic rock, and you can argue with me and tell me if you think I'm wrong, or Kevin Orcutt will. 902, in front of U2's Desire, and right above Bob Seger, Feel Like a Number, Donny Iris, Aaliyah. Do you think that's a classic rock song? It's a good song. Well, I don't know that it's a classic.
I like that song.
No, so do I.
Yeah, I like that song. Yeah, it's Donny Iris too, Pittsburgh guy, still performing in Pittsburgh. I don't know. You know, again, when somebody makes a list like this, you're getting the opinion, whether it's a list that's compiled by one guy or five people. I don't understand it. If they were charting a list of the best songs based off of sales, I could at least understand it a little bit more. But you've got one guy on here that, you know, maybe he's got a hard on for somebody, you know, I'm not sure who it is, you know, but even, you know, just look, Sammy Hagar, Your Love Is Driving Me Crazy, 923. It's a nice song, right? But at the same time, you know, look, it's above several David Bowie songs. Gene Genie coming in at 931. You know, Bruce Springsteen, Tunnel of Love, 941. I like that song. I've always liked that song. And Jeff, a guy that you don't like, which really I think is interesting, Stevie Ray Vaughan having a bunch of songs, but they're all in the lower, like 945 up to 1,000. Cold Shot, which I think is great, 953. Give me a break.
Yeah, as I've said before, Barry, I'm not a huge Stevie Ray Vaughan fan. Hey, sue me. But he definitely is a staple of classic rock radio, definitely belongs on this list, and I would say much higher than this based on the amount of times you hear him, his fan base, which is very hardcore and stuff like that. So, yeah, he definitely should be higher on this list.
Jeff, I like Stevie Ray Vaughan, and for the life of me, I can't figure out how his collection of songs is all coming off 900 or lower, which doesn't make any sense to me. But even, you know, as I look for some of this too, like, you know, Loggins and Messina, Angry Eyes. I mean, I don't know. Is that a song that, you know, needs to be even on this list?
Yeah, again, there are names on here, and I don't mind Loggins and Messina. I like some of their songs, but that's more like the stuff that's going to be on the bridge, you know?
Yeah,
softer side of rock, if you will. Even like, you know, Mama Don't Dance and Your Papa Don't Rock and Roll, which is a good, fun, upbeat song. But is that really classic rock, or is that stuff that should be on the bridge? And, you know, Barry, just because I know you're into this, I would say this genre, Roxy Music at 921. Is that fair for them?
Yeah. You know, so I think my issue with Roxy Music, too, is and we should say, too, the lead singer of Roxy Music, it's kind of, it's cliche. He's the Nick Bockwinkel of new wave music. Whenever somebody says the name Brian Ferry, they always say one of the classiest guys in new wave music, because he's always wearing a suit. So somehow he's got to be super classy because he's wearing a suit, you know, which makes no sense. My issue with Roxy Music, I guess, is that if I never heard one of their songs again, I'd be fine because it's overplayed to death on me. But, you know, look, Love is the Drug was a great song. More than this, much softer, but also a very, very good song. Yeah, I don't know.
Unless I'm just kind of going through off the top of my head here. Okay, here's one, 879. All right. Quiet Riot, Come On, Feel the Noise. Okay, now I got to tell you something. In 1984, that song was fucking everywhere. I mean, like, you just couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't walk 10 steps without hearing that song on one radio station or another. Classic rock must have had that on the spin list every hour on the hour. And how they think that there are 878 songs that are more well, I'm not saying it should be number one or two, but come on, people, that song was all over the fucking radio.
Yeah, it should be too. And when you look at songs that are right below it, 881, REO Speedwagon, Time for Me to Fly. Jeff, I know when I want to get good and fucked up and rock out, I put on REO Speedwagon, Time for Me to Fly, because nothing says headbanger like that. Another name that is popping up on this list is I'm looking at, we're 875 to 1,000. Pat Benatar seems to be popping and populating on this
list.
In
the 800s and 900s, there's like 20 Pat Benatar songs.
Which is bullshit. She's the most underappreciated vocalist for a female rocker. She doesn't get her due. A lot of people will point to her husband. Apparently, her husband, the lead guitarist, Neil Giraldo, is supposed to be super controlling and not well-liked by a lot within the industry. But as people listening to the music, none of that should matter to us. This woman had a string of hits, was able to rock it out with these hits in the 80s, and to see her so low is absolutely crazy. Another name that I see that's here a lot, which I'm sure as we go down, it's Paul McCartney's got a bunch down here. But a lot of these songs, I don't even know these songs. Helen Wheels, do I even know that song?
No,
Jeff?
I know that song.
All right.
That was like around 74 or something like that. So,
okay.
All right. So I'm going to jump up to 840. Okay.
Right.
I do not like Axl Rose at all. I can't specify that enough. But I understand that Guns N' Roses were a pretty significant band over the course of about a 5 or 10 year period. Welcome to the Fucking Jungle is 840. Again, that was a song that was everywhere in the late 80s and in the early 90s because they kept playing that rotation over and over and over again. It's crazy that song is so low.
I don't know if I can do this list, Jeff. As I sit here now, because you're right. Look, I like Welcome to the Jungle. When that song came out, that was a fucking anthem of like 1987 for me. So I'm totally into it. If I never heard the song again, I'd be fine. It's overplayed to death. But Welcome to the Jungle's a top 100 or 200 song. But as I move down to 8:30, you've got Casey Jones by the Grateful Dead, ahead of songs like Welcome to the Jungle, ahead of songs by Deep Purple, Space Truckin'. I mean, you know, give me a fucking break.
Ahead of Psycho Killer by the Talking Heads.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, Bob Seger. Look, Rod Stewart, Jeff, and Rod Stewart playing at Caesar's Palace, I believe, when Sweet Lou and I may be out there as well.
Can we catch a show?
Possibly. Hot Legs, again, it's not one of my favorite songs, but I'll recognize what a massive hit that was. And you're going to put Casey Jones, Grateful Dead above that? Who made this list? This is John McAdam.
Yeah, and this is, well, wait a minute. We haven't got to Billy and the Buckers. Their album up. That was released only in Germany. And, but no, you know, like as you're looking at that, here's another song that wasn't, as big as Casey Jones by the Grateful Dead, Billy Squire, The Stroke. Again, a song that was every hour in the mid 80s, that song was on the fucking radio, you know, and just was everywhere. And somehow Casey Jones, and I understand the Grateful Dead fans are an incredibly rabid fan base, and they still travel all over the country with, there's some band that's, I don't know if they like the Grateful Dead Experience or something like that now with Bob Weir and all those guys.
I think the vocalist, right?
What's that?
John Mayer.
I saw a listing for him, and for some reason they're not called the Grateful Dead anymore. They're called like some sort of alternative, like the Grateful Dead Experience or something like that. But let me see what else really annoyed the hell out of me here. There's just to begin with. Okay, let's jump up. Okay, to the 800s. Okay, and right below that. So we have 797, a song that is kind of a one hit wonder in the States, but the band was really big in Australia. Midnight Oil, Beds Are Burning, which I think is a fantastic song, Barry.
Oh, it is. I actually like a lot of their songs. So I would have, all right. Yeah. So yeah, as I'm looking at this, it just Jethro Tull, Hymn 43 at 786, which, you know, how, like Jethro Tull, hate Jethro Tull. How okay. The fuck does that song get up to 786?
That, by the way, Hymn 43 would be higher than such songs as Pretenders, Middle of the Road, Red Rider, Lunatic Fringe, which is a great song, ELO's Strange Magic, higher than, let's see what else we got here.
Shock the Monkey by Peter Gabriel.
Yeah, that's a great song. So 810, Paradise City is in front of Welcome to the Jungle? What the fuck was that?
And Pacer.
Yeah. How is that higher than Welcome to the Fucking Jungle? I don't understand that at all. So what we're gonna do? Let's go to 700, Barry. And then we'll call it a day, and we can come back next week and bitch and complain about this list even more. So let's see. What else?
Let me ask you a question. What's number 702?
I'm gonna have to rattle some papers, Lou. Let's see. 702 is Bitch by the Stones.
Oh, okay. So they couldn't put.
Yeah, they couldn't say the word bitch because later in the list they have Elton John, The Bitch Is Back, and they don't tell you what the song is. So, okay, here's another example, Barry. Let's go to 731. 731, Norman, not Josh, Greenbaum with Spirit in the Sky. Now, this is a big hit in the late 60s or early 70s. I remember my sister had this 45 record. And you young people probably don't know what 45 records are, and I just made myself feel incredibly old. But No Longer Spirit in the Sky is not a classic rock song. That was completely a pop song, Barry. Do you even know that song?
Yeah, absolutely.
718, Rod Stewart, Every Picture Tells a Story. There's no way there are 717 songs that are better than Every Picture Tells a Story, because that's one of Rod Stewart's best songs, in my opinion.
Steve Winwood, 707 Valerie. Nice song. But here's one. So this is, look, I think this is a great song. And if you've this takes me back to my youth. 706, Jefferson Starship Miracles.
Yeah, Marty Ballin, great song.
Exactly, great song. But I mean, I just, again, when you see what it's surrounded by, you go, how is this possible?
Yeah. Okay, so here's another question, Barry. 715, Paul Simon, Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard. Is that a classic rock song?
I guess. I don't, does it fall into, and let me ask you a question. Every time I meet somebody named Julio, I always throw in Down by the Schoolyard. Do you do that too?
Yes.
Because the guy who does all of our landscaping, the guy's a fucking artist. He can take, you know, by the end of winter, it looks like our house has been demolished with the landscaping. Julio gets out there for an hour and it's like we're in like Caesar's Palace. Like it just, he does this job. But every time I see him, my wife will go, "Where were you?" And I was like, "Yeah, I was out with Julio down by the schoolyard." It gets old quick, Jeff, but we do it. So, yeah.
Are you trying to say you tell the same jokes and stories to your wife all the time?
22 years. Jeff, so this list is completely Leonard Skinnerd, Simple Man, 696. Sorry, you have now lost all credibility. That is an amazing song. That is my favorite Leonard Skinnerd song. That is a top 100 to 200 song. Should not be as low as
okay. By the way, Leonard Skinnerd, Simple Man is behind on the list at 692, Barry. Cat Stevens, Wild World.
And 694, Loggins and Messina, Your Mama Don't Dance. I mean, holy
Talking
shit.
Talking Heads, Once in a Lifetime, apparently not as good a song as Cat Stevens' Wild World. On yeah. that note, Barry, let's wrap up for this week, and we will come back beginning with 691 and below. Oh, Barry, I think we're both going to have our blood pressure go through the roof. People are going to get upset about this.
Oh, yeah. I'm upset. And
by the way, no Oingo Boingo so far on this list. I don't know if you noticed that.
Which I'm fine with. You have given, by not putting them on, you've given it credibility. That's how I look at it.
They're an underground band, man.
Yep.
So, all right, Barry, you better ready to go home here, my man.
I guess so. It's we'll be back next week, Jeff. And yeah, you'll be feeling better. We're hoping, right?
Yeah. So, going to make a quick trek down to Florida to visit my dad and my wife's brother, and then zip back up. So hopefully everything will go well. So until next week, on behalf of my co-host Barry Rose and our producer Sweet Lou Kippelman, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. 691, Tom Petty, Into the Great Wide Open.
Wow.